Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Have you ever been locked in a cooler with piles of decomposing humans for so long that you had to shave all the hair off your body in order to get rid of the smell? Joseph Scott Morgan did. Have you ever lit a Marlboro from the ignited gas of a bloated dead man's belly? Joseph Scott Morgan has. Have you ever wept over a dead dog while not giving a shit about the dead owner laying next to him? Morgan did. Were you named after a murder victim? Joseph Scott Morgan was. This isn't Hollywood fantasy. It's the true story of a boy born into the deprivations of a white trash trailer park who, as an adult, gets further involved in the desperate backdoor sagas of the New South. No hot blondes here, just maggots, grief, and the truth about forensics and death investigation. Joseph Scott Morgan became a death investigator with the Jefferson Parish Coroner's Office in suburban New Orleans in 1987. The youngest medical legal death investigator in the country. During the day, Morgan worked in the morgue and at night investigated for the coroner. In 1992, Morgan became senior investigator with the Fulton County Medical Examiner's Office in Atlanta. Morgan is now the professor at Jacksonville State University in Alabama, where he teaches a death investigation course based on the national standards which he helped develop. The book that we're featuring this evening is Blood Beneath My Feet, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator, with my special guest journalist and author, Joseph Scott Morgan. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Joseph Scott Morgan.
Good evening, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's a real honor.
Thank you very much. I hope that I made that correction in the where you are now working as a college professor. At the University of Jacksonville.
Yeah, it's State it's University. Jacksonville. Yeah, Jacksonville State University in eastern Alabama. We're about 90 minutes from west of downtown Atlanta, so just across the border into the central time zone, which I prefer over the eastern. So there you go.
You are all over Facebook and the internet. I just saw recently, and this is part of a series, I believe, but some appearances on HLN as a guest commentator, talking about the Jeffrey Epstein episode, on this episode. Tell us what else that you are all over the place commenting about. Tell us where else they can see you.
Yeah, I do quite a bit of work with HLN. I've got a lot of friends there. I've been working there appearing since about 2013. I think on the 20th of October, a new series is premiering called The Dead Wives Club, and it's a platform for Lorraine Bracco. Listeners might remember her from The Sopranos and, of course, from Goodfellas. And she's the host of the show, and in the first episode, I'll actually be discussing the death of Natalie Wood, and I'm the medical legal expert on that. And then up here on Dan Abrams' Law and Crime Network out of Manhattan, I'm a commentator, forensics commentator there. I do that 2 to 3 days a week, I guess, for about 3 hours at a time. We do live court coverage there, occasionally court TV, and then a variety of other, you know, podcasts and this sort of thing. And then, of course, that's in addition to my teaching duties and my research into the coroner system in America.
So luckily you're retired, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. It's But you know, it's a, you know, Dan, it's a healthy busy for me. It, it truly is. It's,
yeah,
it's almost purgative in a way. Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is.
As you do write in this incredible book, let's talk about your great uncle Joe and your background, where you come from, and the things in your life that shaped you, before we talk about how you became this death investigator by your own choice.
Yeah, you know, Blood Beneath My Feet was, you know, was a therapeutic work. And when I started the story out, I, you know, started telling my tale. My Uncle Joe had always been a presence in my life. And interestingly enough, he was a homicide victim that had actually died, I think, just over a decade before I was born. But when I was born, he held such a place of honor in my family. I was named after him. And so he was one of six children on my paternal grandmother's side of the family, and her brother, the eldest, and she dearly loved him, and he was a union rep in Louisiana, and he was in charge of painting, giving contracts for painting, and there was a bridge in Louisiana that was had a large amount of money that was attached to it, and actually it linked Faraday, Louisiana, the home of Jerry Lee Lewis, to Mississippi. And this one fellow put in for the bid, didn't get it, and so my uncle was in West Monroe, Louisiana. People might know that from Duck Dynasty if they've ever watched that program years ago. He was back in the 50s getting his hair cut on a, I think it was a Saturday morning, and he stepped out into the street. Fellow that felt he had been wronged by my uncle was waiting in a bar room across the street. Walked out into the street, called his name, and proceeded to gun him down in the middle of the street with a .38 caliber revolver. My uncle crawling beneath a car, freshly cut hair, nicely clothed, and he died, you know, on that dirty street beneath that old car he was trying to get into to escape his own death. And you know, I was named after this man. And so it was an interesting linkage for me, I think. And early on, I thought about him, even as a small child. I remember thinking of him almost in heroic terms, you know, that he died. It was striking to me as a young child.
You write the arrest and the sanity hearing and the trial was front page news for months. What happened to the killer of your grandfather or your uncle? How did that affect your father?
I've traveled a very crooked road. I think even before I was born, that this fellow was acquitted, essentially. Well, he was his prison term he was exonerated, essentially, and released by the governor. And the governor is famously known in Louisiana as the brother of Huey P. Long. This particular governor was portrayed in a movie called Blaze by Paul Newman many years ago. And he was just that crazy. My family felt like they didn't get justice in this trial. This fellow was plugged in politically, and as all people are one way or another in Louisiana. And interestingly enough, my grandmother and her sisters would send a black wreath to this man's home every single year on the anniversary of my Uncle Joseph's murder. And so that, you know, that thread kind of runs through, I think, my family. There was always a weeping, if you will, I think, that silently went on. And even to the day that all those sisters died and they're all dead now, that generation's gone, there was a cloud that kind of, you know, hung over them because of this homicide, that they felt like he was never he was never avenged, essentially. And so that travels down through time. My father was my grandmother's only child, and he was born later in life to my grandmother. And he had this kind of interesting background. He was doted on by his mother and abused by his father there in North Louisiana. They had a horse ranch and farm, and he was beaten regularly. Well, he grew up mean, grew up, you know, spoiled and mean, and that translated into his adult life. He was very violent fellow. And he and my mother wed when they were very young. I think he was 18. My mother was 17. She, by the time she was 18, she was giving birth to me. And there was always a residue of violence that existed with him. He was a scary, you know, scary man, particularly back in his younger days. And until that culminated, I think, when I was about five or six, he came to my grandmother's house, you know, with a belly full of bourbon, and he had a sawed off Ivor Johnson double barrel shotgun. He was proclaiming he was going to kill the whole family. And I was in the house, actually in the backyard, playing in the sand that my grandpa had acquired for me, a big pile of sand. What kid doesn't love that, you know? And they heard him screaming to the driveway. My grandmother ran out, and he was shouting, you know, calling down the thunder from God, I guess. And, and I have vivid memories of her pulling me in the house and locking the door. And my grandfather was already in the house, she thrust me under the bed. And, you know, I can still have a memory, and I write about it in Blood Beneath My Feet, of looking out from beneath the bed, and you could see her knees as she was beside the bed praying, you know, asking God to save her from her own son. And it was that imprinted in my memory, you know, long after that. It stayed with me for years and years, Dan. And he was throwing heavy metal furniture, you know, against the back of the house. He was screaming out for his father's blood, that he was going to come in and kill us and kill his father in particular. The man had treated him so roughly as a child, and he blasted off the shotgun a couple of times. And it, you know, in the interim, they had called back then. You couldn't call 911. This was back in the late 60s. They called zero. And the deputy sheriffs in Washtenaw Parish showed up. And I remember them really, you know, taking my father to school. I have an image of him with blood, you know, coming off out of his nose. I looked out the window of my grandma's living room, and he was handcuffed. And I think I talked about stalwart men in khaki uniforms and straw cowboy hats, you know, and they became my heroes. You know, I saw what they had done. They walked into this situation and drug him away, and and hauled him off to the parish, that we don't have counties in Louisiana, parish lockup. And there, you know, the rest of his life was set in motion. Back then, they used to tell young violent men, you got one of two choices. You know, you either go to the penitentiary, you join the Marine Corps, and go to Vietnam. And he decided to join the Corps.
Now, what happens with your mother? You introduce a character named Bruce. Look like it seemed like answers to everybody's problems right at that time. Tell us about Bruce and your life with Bruce and after your dad was in the military and gone.
When my father got home from Vietnam, he was probably, and from his service in the Marine Corps, he's probably more damaged than when he went in. And he promptly moved us to Georgia from Louisiana. And you have to keep in mind, my grandmother had essentially been raising me. My mother worked full time. We lived in a trailer that was on their property. And on my grandparents' property. And he being, you know, he had talked about moving to, when he got out of the Marine Corps, he was going to move us to Australia. He was going to do construction down there, take us out to LA. And then finally, for whatever reason, he settled on Georgia. And I had cousins that were already living in Georgia. Georgia, even back then around the Atlanta area, was booming. And this was, you know, the early 70s. took us there, and I guess probably within 18 months of us moving to Georgia, he promptly abandoned my mother and I. I mean, we had nothing. We were living in a trailer park, run, you know, by this old man that, you know, was an interesting character, to say the least. And my mother, she's still very young, very beautiful, and she was trying to make her way, you know, as best she could, and she was working for a textile company, and she met this guy that was in sales that happened to be there, and he was refined. He was everything that my father was not. He was college educated, appeared to be successful, but he had this kind of thread of hyper religiosity that ran through him. And this is kind of a theme that runs through Blood Beneath My Feet. There's this, you know, this kind of warring that I do, you know, growing up as a Southern evangelical, in that, you know, in that time frame of my life, you know, you're fighting to try to be obedient to your parents and to what you perceive God wants you to do with your life. And then you're fighting for your own survival. I don't know, you know, the sort of thing, I don't know if I can endure this any longer. And so for me, he entered my world, Bruce did. And, it was all, you know, all fine and dandy at first. He was wooing my mother, you know, vis-a-vis, you know, through me, essentially, you know, promising me things that I'd never had, going to pro ball games and college football games and taking us out. And we were living on bologna sandwiches, living in a house trailer, Dan. I mean, we had nothing. And my mother saw it as a way for us to kind of pull ourselves out of this horrible situation that we were kind of living in. Because, I mean, we didn't have dime one and hardly had any food. And, you know, she married him, wound up marrying him very quickly. And hell soon followed thereafter with him. I think I received probably, I think I was, they married when I was nine. He beat me for the first time 2 months after they were married. And then it continued on, you know, I guess until, you know, severely, you know, until I was probably 14 or so.
So you've come from, needless to say, a background of abuse. How do you get to overcoming this to become, and first work for a coroner in New Orleans? How do you get to a death investigator? How do you tell us about that?
Well, yeah. You know, the thing about it is this. I'd always been told by my abuser, Bruce, that I was never going to amount to anything, that I was worthless. And, of course, the old thing that comes through is you're going to wind up just like your dad. And I've fought that my entire life. My wife will say there's no need to fight that fight anymore. You know, God bless her. You know, she tells me that. And, you know, she has to still to this day has to tell me that I'm a success, you know, because that doubt, it's amazing what you kind of imprint on your kids, you know, when they're little, you know, when you hear that, or those children that are in your charge. And so that was always imprinted, in my psyche. And so I always fought it. And when I took this kind of circuitous route, wound up back down in kind of where our ancestral home is down in South Louisiana. I was born in North Louisiana, but all of my family lived in South Louisiana in the New Orleans area, and had uncles down there and extended family. And I finally wound up down there, showed up in town with nothing, essentially. I tried college, didn't do too well. I was in the National Guard and the Army, and kind of transferred Guard membership, was down there with them. And I was really just seeking. I happened to be working in a hospital, and the parish at that particular time, this is in, I guess, probably about 84, maybe. The parish was renovating their morgue, and it was unsustainable. You know, it was just horrible. It was, the morgue was actually built on the site of the old gallows down in Gretna, Louisiana, where the Jefferson Parish Coroner's Office was at one time headquartered. And they actually used to do, at the parish level, public executions there back in the 1800s. And and the morgue itself was built into the prison. And so you had to go through actual security to get into the morgue. Well, they were trying to renovate this thing to make it viable. Morgues are very expensive, and they wanted to try to maintain this thing until they could come up with a better solution. So the coroner's office started doing autopsies at a hospital that I happened to be working at. And I was working as – I first started off as a security guard, then I started working as an ER tech while I was going to college down there. And I was very young. I guess I was 20. Maybe 21, I guess. And I just started bringing bodies in and out of the morgue, and I became friends with one of the coroner investigators, who turns out to be one of the finest forensic scientists that I've ever known, one of the finest investigators that I've ever known. He and I became fast friends, and I found myself, of all things, showing up. And you know you're in trouble when you do this. I was actually showing up to autopsies on my free time. I wasn't getting paid. And I was in that morgue day in and day out cleaning. I'd just mop up blood and maggots and, you know, clean the morgue. I tell my college students now, you know, they said, "Professor Morgan, I want to do what you did for a living. How'd you start?" And I said, "I volunteered." And you can see their countenance immediately drop because they have an expectation they're going to be paid for whatever they want to do. And so I became a diener, which is actually translates from German to servant. And it's a term that's used for people that prosect bodies, were the ones that actually put the cold steel to the bodies. And it just, it kind of evolved. I found out I had a natural talent at it. And they first allowed me to close bodies, which is just using a standard old baseball stitch. That's putting all of the organs back in the body in a big plastic bag. I'm sure a lot of your true crime listeners are very familiar. They've heard about autopsies before. And then finally I graduated to opening bodies. And there was a position that came open as a coroner investigator. And I had started doing this. I started dissecting in 1985. And it turns out these people, my life, it's weird how life is. You intersect with all of these people around, along your path, and you don't really realize it. And a guy that was working there, some listeners might be familiar with him. He was at the end of his career. His name's Dr. William Eckert. And he's one of the most renowned forensic pathologists in the country. He's deceased now. And I started actually working with him as an older fellow. And he taught me a lot. I learned a lot from all of the forensic pathologists that I worked with. And I applied for a job as a coroner investigator, I think, three times. And the two people that got the job before me only lasted 6 months each. And, dude, I was still going to the morgue to dissect bodies. And they said, "Well, let's give this kid a chance. You know, he's there every single day. He's not really, we're not paying him anything." And in the meantime, in addition to that, at night, I would go out on scenes with the coroner investigator when I wasn't working, just to carry, you know, just to carry his equipment, you know, to help him take, he would teach me photography, he taught me everything. And of course they were using me to do scut work too, because I was crawling under houses to drag out maggot infested bodies. And I just, you know, and I think looking back on it, people will say, you know, how could you do that? Well, I would always say to myself, Dan, that look, you know, and I think I mentioned this in the chapter called For Scythia in the book, you know, maggot infested body, it's not Bruce. You know, brain splattered on the wall, it's not Bruce. You know, tortured female, nipples cut off, you know, sexually abused with a whiskey bottle. I had a case like that. It's still not Bruce. I can handle this. And no one else wanted the job. And so I found myself in an odd position as a very, very young man. I truly didn't have any business doing the job I was doing at the age I was at, because I had these older investigators that soon would look to me for advice as far as the medical legal perspective went. And where I really gleaned my education, even though I have a graduate degree in forensic science, the best education I ever got was the morgue. I mean, it's, you know, there's an old adage that says, see one, do one, teach one. And after you've dissected, prosected as many human cadavers as I've participated in and dissected, something's going to stick. And I read a lot on my own. This is before, way before the internet. It's way before people even knew what the coroner did, and certainly didn't know what went on in an autopsy room. It was my classroom, and it just opened a whole new world to me.
You talk about the jobs that you have to do, and you talk and give examples in the book with your first death scene, which was in New Orleans. Just for example, again, just to show the how profound this is the first death scene that you attend to in New Orleans. Tell us about this body that's there for over a month. What do you encounter as you do and so graphically describe in this book about the man with the schizophrenia on the first death scene? What do you find?
If I'm remembering the story correctly, it's a horrific scene in the sense that there's a sense this absence of humanity is kind of the way you describe it, because you begin to look at these bodies that are so decomposed and rotted and desiccated and absent of anything that might have given an indication of animus at any point in time. You know, there's nothing there for many people that resembles a living, breathing human being. And after you've done it for a while and it shocks your system, you begin to, I think, see their world come into focus, maybe more clearly than it's ever been in focus before. It goes to a greater idea, and something that I have still struggle with day in and day out, because I've spent so much time with death, is that death is stalking. Death is stalking us all the time, and you never know when it's going to present itself. For me as a young man, when I, would encounter particularly decomps, I had to get past, I knew very early on, I had to get past my revulsion to what was being presented to me visually, what was being presented to me from an olfactory sense, and just you're inhaling this,
right?
And at the end of the day, you're inhaling part of what they are. And even from an auditory sense, if no one has ever heard a maggot husk pop, you can literally hear this, and you hear the buzzing of the flies that light on you that have previously been feasting on the body, and you become kind of one in this environment, and you better show up with your A game, or it will begin to kind of it begins to eat away. You begin to slowly decompose, along with the body. You just do it at a slower rate because you still have your metabolic process. That's your Krebs cycle still firing off in life, but there's kind of a lot of parallels here. And most people in the workaday world have no appreciation for this. They don't have any concept of it, that this is happening day in and day out, that somewhere out there right now there is some young medical legal death investigator that is hovering over a decomposing human being, and they're having to make heads or tails of it. And you're very confused at that age. You feel like you don't know, and decomps are the worst, because you always feel like the body is hiding something for you, or that evidence has already, left the building, if you will, because they're so far gone at that point.
You include a story about assuming something when first encountering a situation, but you are trained to investigate fully. But you find a baby, and then you have to obviously question the mother. at first it looks like it just might be a natural death. Tell us about what happens there and the kind of feelings that you're supposed to be impartial, not bring sympathy to the table as you write. What happens in this particular case, despite your training?
It's very difficult, Dan. I think for anyone that is, you know, when you're attempting to try to make heads or tails out of what has taken place, and you want to give parents and people kind of the benefit of the doubt, if you will, relative to you know what you're viewing, you know, in real time. What is it about the scene that you can draw your own conclusions, but yet still remain as objective as possible? And sometimes that is you have hell to pay with that, because you can't just simply, you know, check your feelings at the door, your humanity, I think, if you will. And it's very, very difficult because of the you want to try to maintain an air of objectivity, but there are just those moments in time where you essentially want to rid the world, I think, of certain people. You know, I think from Jump Street, you want to try to be able, you wish that your paths had never crossed, essentially, I think is what it is. And when you're a child of abuse, it's particularly difficult in that you have this thing that, you know, that kind of, where you see yourself as some kind of protector, if you will, for all children, and you know, to recover those things. And if I'm remembering this story correctly, you know, I roll it back to the moment that my grandmother actually protected me by placing me beneath a bed, you know, in the face of what was happening with my own situation with my father, you know, protecting me. But there's not enough people out there to protect them. When I was little, you know, my mother would, I had terrible earaches, and she would rock me, and she would sing the old song called Down in the Valley, and it would bring a lot of peace to me and soothing. And you have children out there that, as bad as my childhood was, you still come across what remains of these children that are abused and abandoned, and people move on from them, and they're never remembered. But for me, as a medical legal death investigator, I do remember them. You know, I do remember, you know, what the parents failed to do, or what they did do by you know, just their sins of commission. You know, that they brutalize children and do horrible things to them, but yet they go on about their life. But that little life is snuffed out, and it's very hard to kind of reconcile in your own brain, I think, many times. And it leaves scars. It certainly leaves scars.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity, Joseph, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Honey. Ever buy something online and then find out you could have gotten it for less? It's worse than getting wrong directions. After that, you think you might be overpaying every time you shop. Luckily, I have Honey. the free browser extension that saves you time and money when shopping online. Honey scans the internet for coupon codes and other discounts. Then, like magic, it automatically applies the one with the biggest savings to your card at checkout. It knows about every coupon code, sale, or discount at over 20,000 sites like Amazon, Macy's, J.Crew, Domino's, Sephora, Target, and more. Just shop like normal and Honey finds you savings. And believe me, it feels amazing, like saving on everything you buy from now on, amazing. I buy a lot of books, and last week I bought The Menendez Murders, Robert Rand. He's going to be a guest in a couple weeks. I got the paperback for $16.10. I saved an amazing $6.20 on a book I was expecting to pay full price. $6 saving. It's exciting saving money. Honey has found its 10 million users over $1 billion in savings. Listen, there's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and installs on your computer in just two clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/murder. That's joinhoney.com/murder. Now, Joseph, as you write in the book, the hardest thing to get out of your mind and the hardest thing to do as your role as a death investigator is to the notification of next of kin. A particular case that you bring up is a trip that you had with someone as a friend and a mentor named Bill Donovan and his friend, which was a federal judge named Lance Mitchell. This story clearly illustrates and demonstrates how hard it is doing this job, and especially was probably pivotal in you leaving this job sooner than you might have. Tell us about this
Bill, the fellow I mentioned earlier, was my mentor, and as in many things in life, when you become friends with people, you inherit their friends essentially, or you strike up relationships peripheral to that individual, and that's what happened with Bill's friend Lance, and I write about this particular case. And we were, I'm from Louisiana, so that, by default, that automatically makes me an LSU fan, Louisiana State University. Yeah. And his father, Lance's father, and who was also a big influence in Bill's life, was federal judge and was a part of a lot of the early civil rights decisions in the South, safeguarding the rights of African Americans. He'd been threatened on numerous occasions by the Klan over the years back in the 60s and was very stalwart. And he was just this, his dad, the federal judge, and I write about it in the book, he would arrive at the campus at LSU and he was like this kind of demigod. When he'd show up, everybody would pull up a chair for him and pour him a couple fingers of bourbon, and the tales would start to be told. And that's kind of the part of, being a Southern storyteller. With Lance, I became friends with him, and Lance was somewhat of an interesting character. He was kind of playboy, judge's son, and he never got into, big trouble or anything. He was one of the cool kids, but he was affable, and a real Southern gentleman. And he had finally, after all this time, had settled on a young lady. And we felt as though they were, going to be a great match. And Bill had a tiny little house that he was renting at the time, he and his wife. But what was really great about it, particularly in South Louisiana, is it's so bloody hot, is the fact that he had a swimming pool. And so any party that was to be had, it would be had at Bill's house. And it was Memorial Day, and we had gathered together. And Bill and I obviously were both off duty, and Lance had come. We had hot dogs and beers and sat around, and just on a Memorial Day, and just really enjoyed the fellowship with one another, and laughing and carrying on like we always did. And it's one of those moments in time for me. I can't, you know, obviously everybody's journey is different. I can't speak for anybody else, but when I look back on it, you know, it sounds rather Pollyanna, you know, to talk about, you see how fleeting life is and you don't understand all these intersections and this sort of thing. And you really don't, though. I mean, that's about as real as it gets. You don't know when the last time you're going to see somebody is. That is, at least in the state of living. And so you, for me, with Lance, he and Bill were like brothers. And there was a general love that these two had for them. And I happened to be on duty. I guess it was, I can't remember now. My mind fails me at this point, but it was a week later, maybe, I think. And I got a call from the local hospital when I was on duty. It was in the evening. And Lance had a car that had T-tops in it. And he straightened out a curve coming off of I-10 in New Orleans. And both he and his girlfriend were ejected from a vehicle. And what normally happens with a coroner's call in a violent death is anybody that dies of violence, you know, whether it's homicide or accident or whatever the case is, suicide, it doesn't matter, that the emergency room staff has to call the coroner's office, and the coroner investigator on duty, you know, will answer the phone and most of the time respond even to the ER, not just to the scene, because we like to gather as much information. And it was one of those kind of moments that stands still in time. And, you know, I'd probably already taken maybe 10 other deaths that night, you know, over the course of just doing what I did as a coroner investigator. Some I had to go out on scenes on, others I didn't. Some I had to go to the hospitals. And for that moment, Tom, she said, we've got two victims here, both in MVAs, ejections. The male's name is Lance. And I remember writing that down. And then she said, Mitchell. And, it was one of those moments literally where I said, can you repeat that name? And I said, he's white male. And then she gave his date of birth. And I was like, I'm headed to the hospital now. And I got in my vehicle and grabbed my scene kit, you know, just like I was going to a homicide. And I remember driving over there and you know, you walk in to these emergency room trauma rooms. And Dan, if you've never been in one, they're like a surgical suite almost, because, and this is the only reason, it begins and here ends here. They have these very bright surgical lights that almost give this artificial luminescence. So it's kind of eerie in a weird kind of way, the lighting in there, and it shows things that you don't, it super enhances your vision, I think. And there he was, head was bandaged, but his head was misshapen. And I knew it was Lance, you know, when I eyeballed him, and his fiance lay on a gurney in the adjacent room. And again, she had severe head trauma. And I remember having to go tell Bill what had happened. And I didn't want to have to go to the judge's home to do this, because I'd been to the judge's home many times and Bill was almost like family with them. But over the course of my career, as kind of an aside, part of the whole process of notification of next of kin, like you mentioned, it actually falls to the medical legal death investigator. I've done, I think, close to 2,000 by the end of my career, where you physically either go to the emergency room or you go in person to a home and notify people. And these are on all kinds of deaths. It's not, you know, coroners don't just simply work homicides. Homicides are a very small portion of what we do. People die of other reasons. And it never gets easy. The last one I ever did was just as hard as the first one. It's not one of these things that, you know, you develop special muscles for. Bill, I called him, woke him up out of a dead sleep. And I remember just telling him, man, Lance is dead. You know, he's dead. And we had the ability to talk very frankly with one another as fellow medical legal death investigators. And immediately he said, I'm going to judge's house right now. And he left, no weeping, nothing. And then the next time I heard from Bill was probably 3 hours later, and he was roaring drunk. And Bill had duty. He had duty that day. That means that he was going to be working as a deaner. And he called me up, and through his slurred speech, he, you know, he told me at that moment in time that he would not be capable of doing these autopsies. And it was a crossroads in my life, both in my physical and mental health. At this point in time, I made a decision. This is one of those moments you can look back in time and say, you should have chosen B instead of A. And being the stalwart, you know, flinty-faced Southern male that I was, that I could stand up to anything, I said, don't worry, I'll rush in and do it. And I wound up dissecting these two people that I'd been eating hot dogs with the week before. And it affected me down to my soul, more so than anything else that I ever did as a medical legal death investigator. And I'm talking about thousands and thousands of bodies that I've stood over, either on the street as a death investigator or in the morgue as an autopsy assistant, pathology assistant. Nothing else ever affected me like that. And when I wrote Blood Beneath My Feet, I remember reflecting back, because when you use, you know, you hear it in Hollywood a lot, you'll hear those high-speed saws that we use in the morgue. They're agitating saws.
Right.
If people have ever had a cast removed, they're called Striker saws. That's the brand. It's kind of like saying Scotch tape. But Striker is the most well-known. And when I fired up that Striker saw to open both of their skulls, or what remained, because their heads were pretty traumatized, Striker saw creates a histamine. It's a bone histamine. It's very fine. And even if you're wearing a mask, you're still going to inhalate it. And I remember as I was writing Blood Beneath My Feet and kind of weeping over the keys, if you will, I remember thinking back to kind of at that moment in time, I was literally inhalating my friend, or, you know, what was left of his mortal shell. And it was very powerful for me, I think, reflectively. And, you know, Dan, at the time that I was doing this, it was really hard. It was harder reflectively for me. I wept for a couple of days. I went into a really deep spiral after I wrote that chapter. It was very, very difficult, very difficult. But there, you know, there's no one else. We're a very small community, Dan, within the medical legal community. You know, you got cops. There's a lot of homicide investigators that are out there.
Sure.
And God bless them. A lot of them are friends. But, you know, for people like me, I think when I left the field in 2005, there were collectively, and this is counting elected coroners, deputy coroners, medical examiner investigators from all over the country, there's a total of about 600 of us. And we handle all of the deaths nationwide. We're the point of contact relative to any death that occurs, not just homicides, but all the suicides, tons of accidents, unexplained deaths, all these things, you know, that we have to view and try to make judgments over. We're the eyes and the ears of the forensic pathologist. And there's no one else to kind of step in the gap, you know. And I know people it might be listening to this and saying, well, you're an idiot. Why in the hell didn't you go and have someone else do this? Bill and I were the only two in that office. We were the only two autopsy assistants. And there were probably five or six other bodies that I dissected that same day. So there's just sometimes, you know, when you're forced into these positions where you have to do it. It was hard. It was probably professionally one of the most difficult things I ever had to do.
You talk about your job that you had to do, you were forced to do, and you felt that responsibility. You talk about that earlier than this event, that you start compensating by drinking alcohol. What is it that happens, and what are the characteristics? What are the symptoms of your ailment that are evident? You say that you talk about you cried at this, and you say that's not a good idea because people will think what of you. Tell us about that perception of somebody crying And what was your incremental descent? What did it characterize itself by?
I think the issue that I make with showing emotion in the face of this, it's even at a higher level than you see with cops, you know, because you hear about cops not wanting to show emotion, all this thing. Most police officers, their job is completely different than ours. You know, keep in mind, we don't go out and as medical legal death investigators and find lost kids. There's no silent burglar alarms going off. There's no drunken husbands to pull off of wives and save the wives and the kids. That doesn't happen for us. Everything we do day in and day out is death. I mean, and that's it. I mean, we're either notifying a family or we're trying to determine what the manner and cause is, or we're trying to get a body identified. And so what makes matters even worse is the fact that your boss is a physician. And for those that have never worked for physicians, there are several different types, but when your boss is actually not just a physician, but they're a pathologist, and not only a pathologist, but a forensic pathologist, there's a reason physicians go into forensic pathology. Now, they'll say, I'm a curious person, I like the science of it and all that sort of thing. Yeah, and they're not dealing with patients. You know, they're not dealing with the living. So that gives you, I know I'm painting with a very broad brush, but I'm qualified to do that. I've come across too many of them. They don't make the best managers of people, if you will. When I was in Atlanta, for instance, I had a boss that told me, because I was a senior investigator, he says, I know you're having trouble, but you need to suck it up. There's a lot of people around here that look up to you. And, you know, and I look back on that now and I think about, you know, the price that I paid, you know, for being manly, you know, of perception of, because look, we're talking about death, Dan. No one beats death is the house, and you never beat the house. If you want to put it in terms of a casino, death is always going to win. And my issue was that I always felt as though I could go toe to toe with death and beat it in the end. And you never do. You never do. It's a cool thing, you know. I think that when you're a young man, it's a siren song, because you know, you talk about it's your own arrogance. You know, you talk about, hey, man, it's like, hey, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a stockbroker, or I sell insurance, or I drive a bus, or whatever it is. What do you do? Well, I'm a medical legal death investigator. Well, what is that? Well, you know, I investigate deaths. I work for the coroner, and everybody's, ooh, you know, that's really cool. And they want to hear all of your stories. And when you're young, you want to give them all of your stories. But then at the end of the day, you suddenly realize that your stories are just vicarious entertainment for those that are listening to you. At the end of the day, you're still left with all of the screams. You're still left with all of the emptiness. You're still left with the reality that they don't know, and what they're not aware of that they go through life numb with many times is the fact that death is creeping up on them. And as you delve deeper into these things like alcohol or sex or whatever it is that you're using to numb yourself with throughout your life, or overeating as a medical legal death investigator, you try to numb yourself as much as you can, because death is waiting around the corner. You don't feel like that you have anything to lose, you know, because you truly know the reality of what's out there, what kind of waits in the darkness for you. I think that, you know, public in general, they kid themselves in thinking that it's not going to come their way, but it really does. And I stopped a long time ago. I hate the question why. And a lot of the stuff you see on television and, you know, through whatever channel you happen to look at on a daily basis for your entertainment, or these things that you hear us talk about on air or even in podcasts, people say, well, why did they do this? Why is a fool's errand in death investigation? It you might can answer it sometimes. I prefer science. I like to know what, you know, when, where, how, those sorts of things. But why is so nebulous and kind of squishy? And it's a lawyer's word many times. And, you know, you it's kind of almost a whiny, childlike term. You know, why? Sometimes you're not going to get the answer to that question. I have to try to ground myself scientifically as a death investigator and as an educator. You know, I can look to motivations, I guess, to a certain degree, but does anyone ever really know why? And then you start to get off into the, you know, the more metaphysical issues with that too. And you can drive yourself to madness. And a lot of people have the question of why is, as you know, we've got mental health facilities. We've got people roaming the streets day to day. We've got people suffering from depression. A lot of it begins with that core question of why. And I'm chief among sinners, man. I mean, I've asked that question for many years, and I've tried to make some kind of mission on my part to extricate that word out of my vernacular. You know, you sit around. I've covered everything, everything from the Vegas shooting. I was on air the night the Vegas shooting occurred. The Olympic Park bombing. I worked that. You know, the I don't know, the Buckhead mass shooting, the day trader shooting back in the late 90s. I worked that. You know, we had 16 people killed. I've covered, you know, the mass shooting down in Orlando. And you know, if you sit there and you ask why did these things happen, you'll never get a clear answer to it. You never really will. Nothing that'll actually satisfy, because once you think you have an answer to that, the next why question shows up at your door. And so it can be very, very difficult. It's a slippery slope is what it is.
You provide an incredible example of a lot of things that you're talking about here. The gallows humor that the cops employ to survive. Sometimes you guys have a sense of humor about these things, nicknaming certain things. Then again, there's certain levels of even you're outraged at the behavior you write in a book of somebody at a crime scene cracking jokes, treating the scene very, very lightly. But you talk about going to a scene and a young man or a man is dressed in women's clothing. He's a victim of autoerotic asphyxiation. And then the hardest thing that you have to do is, well, of course, there's a humor, the cops cracking some jokes about this guy. And you say, you know, I'd hate to be the butt of the jokes like this person. But then you have to call this person's mother. And this Southern
right.
lady, this Southern belle,
mm-hmm.
Says, how did my son die? And then you, how can you put it? You tell her, this is how he died, erotic asphyxiation, and she doesn't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And when you explain it
own,
further.
Yeah. Yeah. It's my that was my own intellectual arrogance on my part. And I forever to my shame for that, because, you know, here this woman is, she's located up in Virginia, Tidewater area, and her son, you know, chose to participate in this activity. And of course he was found many days later decomposing. Devices were still hooked up to his body. And it was a scary kind of scene, you know, when you go into this thing, there's an electronic device that's still hooked up, and we're, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, I'm looking at him splayed out on the floor and the condition that he's in. And, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, they're looking to me to literally unplug this thing. I'm thinking, well, and I'm a scientist. I understand that probably if this thing had actually caused its death, it would have shorted out. It would have blown. But still, there's that thing in your mind. I'm going to touch this thing, and this is the last thing I'm going to see before I die. And, you know, I remember thinking that. And, of course, I unplugged it, and I began to examine his body. And then you have to think about, well, what do I tell his mom? You know, how do I say this? Well, my intellectual arrogance at the time, I thought that I would impress her with this fancy term that's now very common in the vernacular. Back when this occurred, I guess this was probably in the mid-80s, there was not a lot of knowledge of it, you know, unless you watched, I don't know, Geraldo or something like that, maybe. But, you know, it wasn't, people weren't as educated back then. And I remember having the police up in this area in Virginia go and go to her home and tell her to call me as they stood by. And I remember telling her over the phone when she asked me, well, sir, you know, how exactly did my son die? And I remember telling her, well, yeah, ma'am, it was autoerotic asphyxia, you know. And, of course, the question that follows immediately after that is, what in the world is that? And, you know, how do you explain that to a boy's mama? You know, how do you explain that to him? You know, to her, you know, how, you know, it's real easy to be at the scene and you're trying to cope with what you're seeing and then to have to shift gears immediately while you're going, you know, 60 miles per hour down the road and you kind of throw it into reverse and all of a sudden you're dealing with a child's mother. And I say, you know, make him sound like he's a young man. Everybody, if you're a parent, everybody's, you know, all your children will always be your babies. He's a 30-year-old man, and he's engaging in this behavior, but it's still her baby. You know, how do you back off on that? And lots of times, it's a hell of a job to have to do to try to grasp on to your ability to still have enough humanity within you to walk a mile in their shoes. And keep in mind, Dan, going back to our earlier conversation, this woman didn't ask why. She just wanted to know how. And, you know, that's the thing with a lot of families. They want to know how. They want to know where. And it's amazing how many times you get the where question, because when you tell them their child is dead or any loved one, the first thing out of their mouth is where. Where are they? Where are they? They just want to flee to them, hoping against hope that there's something left there that they can grab hold of and love on one more time. Of course, by that time, it's too late.
You write about your breakdown, your tremors at the scene. Was there any call or need, or had you had ever attended any counseling, psychologists or psychiatrists before this time? Tell us what is you're forced to do and why.
It's a very, very dark time in my life. And I think that my job, even though I was highly regarded by this time at the end of my career in my profession, I was, you know, one of the 12 people that helped establish the national standards for medical legal death investigation. I was actually on what was called the Milwaukee Task Force, which was established by Dr. Jeff Jensen, who, if your listeners are familiar with him, he's actually the guy that did all the autopsies on the Dahmer victims. He was the chief medical examiner from Milwaukee County. Very bright man, and he saw a need for kind of standardization for death investigators, medical legal death investigators nationwide, those working for coroners and medical examiners. And I was chosen to be among that group, and I'm very honored. And so I attained these heights, and I had, again, going back to this narrative that you can't escape death, I was right in the middle of death and didn't realize that he was breathing down my neck. And all the while, as highly regarded as I regarded myself, you know, which is the ultimate in arrogance, I began to develop tremors. And I think a lot of this goes back also to the things that I had encountered early on in my life, childhood abuse and that sort of thing. And again, I'm kind of layering this thing to prove that I am the man that I can be. I'm tougher than anything else. And at the end of the day, I wasn't. Tremor started, I guess, tremors had probably started 2 to 3 years beforehand. And I continued to kind of bull rush my way through, you know, every single day. But as time went by, then I would, and this is a horrible way to kind of spend your life, that we would work 10-hour shifts. And when I would get off on my final, I would clock out at the medical examiner's office in Atlanta. I was not celebrating the fact that I was off for 3 days. I would be suffering from major depression, sitting in my car, knowing that I would have to come back in 3 days. And that's the way I lived my life. Right. I would spend my days off dreading the fact that I would have to come back to work. And that's an unsustainable position. And as time went by, I was gaining a lot of weight. I was eating just to kind of self-soothe myself. Drinking wasn't as bad as it had been previously in my life. My health was not good. I was not exercising. I worked a lot of nights, slept during the day. And I began feeling myself becoming short of breath on a regular basis. And I wouldn't tell anybody because, you know, I'd taken out hearts out of bodies that were the size of canned hams. You know, I knew what atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease was. You know, I knew what strokes were. You know, I dissected enough brains. And I knew that this was creeping up on me, and I knew that it was there, but I was going to continue to fight it until, I guess it was probably, started about 6 months out from my final day at work. I had chest pain so bad going into work, that I had to literally stop at an emergency room, and they checked me in and they said, no, your heart is perfectly healthy. Nothing's happening here. Take these. And they gave me some tranquilizers and sent me on my way. You know, after being overnight, I had to go back home. And then I was back on duty 2 days later. It happened again, I guess a month later. And again, the same thing. They put me on the EKG. I did a stress test. Everything was clear. And then finally, I was sitting at my desk. I'd just been out to eat with one of my closest friends from childhood who was actually an Atlanta police detective. And I sat down in my chair, and the room literally began to spin. And it was the oddest thing. I'm sitting there in the medical examiner's office. I'm not looking at a dead body. I'm not standing over a dead body. I'm just in the investigator's area. And I remember, as if I was a drowning man, I remember gasping for breath, asking somebody to help me. And I was laying on the floor, crawling out of my cubicle. And I was on day shift at the time. And my colleague that was down the row from me said, call the doctors. Well, the unfortunate part of that is at a medical examiner's office, when you say call the doctors, you're surrounded by forensic pathologists. And this was my worst nightmare come to pass. They picked me up, a bunch of the investigators did. They put me on a sofa in our day room, which is kind of our ready room where there's a TV there. And it's the same room we'd watched the planes fly into the buildings, you know, 9/11. And, right. You know, we keep it on for news. And I remember every doctor in the building showed up, and here I am laying on the sofa, gasping for breath like a fish on a dock outside of water. And looking up, and there are nothing but these faces of these forensic pathologists staring down at me. And I'm feel as though I'm at the portal of hell at this moment in time. And then the coolest thing happened. I remember distinctly hearing the sound. Our rear gate at the medical examiner's office made this huge clanking noise. And I remember hearing the sound of a Grady hospital ambulance coming down the road, running code 3, I would assume, to me. And the last day, literally the last time I ever left a medical examiner's office, was in the back of an ambulance. I've never been so happy to see EMTs in my life. And, you know, it was a hard process. They wound up taking me to the hospital. The young physician was there. He was a cardiologist. He said, "Have you ever been seen by a psychiatrist?" And I was like, What, are you kidding me? No.
Yeah.
You need to see a psychiatrist. And, of course, they sent me to a psychiatrist, she said it's a lady that had immigrated from India many years ago and done her internship up in the Northeast at a veterans hospital. And she said, "You're the worst case of PTSD I've seen since my residency during the Vietnam era." And I was at a point where I was just shaking uncontrollably, almost twitching uncontrollably. She said, "We've got to slow your mind down." And the only thing that could come out of my mouth was like, work. And she said, "Mr. Morgan, you will never go back to work." And she said, "And if you do, I will have you judicially committed." And when that, when she hit me with that, I knew that at the end, I thought that it was the end of my life. I really did. She socked me right in the nose with that reality. And they put me in on these very, very strong medications. She says, "We have got to let your brain rest." She says, "Nobody needs to be around death this long." And there were no programs in place for any kind of help for someone like myself at that time. As a matter of fact, my wife was pregnant. She was a school teacher. I think probably when I was at my worst, I was out of work, I was on short-term disability, and she had contacted the county, Fulton County, and through tears, she's like, "What are we supposed to do?" And the person that she was speaking with with the county at the time actually said, and this is back in 2005, they actually told my wife over the phone. She says, "Your husband's not going to qualify for disability. PTSD is too easy to fake." And I knew at that point in time that I was either going to have to get better and pull myself up and help my family survive, or I was going to have hell to pay. And I was still coming through therapy. My wife was pregnant with our son, Isaac. And Isaac died. He died on September the 20th while I was still recovering. And man, I tell you, he died in my arms. And I used to think back then, all those years ago, I used to think, when I go to make a notification to a family, I hope that I'm compassionate enough with families when I'm talking to them that at some point in time, at some juncture along the way, somebody will be kind to my family when I'm notified, when they're notified of my death. Maybe that'll happen. Maybe that's, you never know what the future holds. And when Isaac breathed his last breath in my arms, he had a congenital defect. I literally notified myself of my own son's death. And Isaac was a real turning point for our family at that moment in time. And it was hard. I mean, it was really, really hard. It was hard finding a therapist, I think, sustainable for me, because it's not like I'm something special. It's just that not too many people have encountered kind of the volume of things that I've seen and that I had done. And in my instance, and keep in mind, not everybody's the same way. I was damaged when I showed up, all those years ago as the quote-unquote youngest medical legal death investigator in the world or in the U.S. or whatever it was that the doctor had called me at that particular time. I was young, but I was damaged when I showed up at the door. And so I was bringing baggage in with me. But still, I finally found a guy that was a Vietnam vet. Who was a PhD, actually at the University of Georgia. And I began to see him and, through a lot of meditation, tried to stay away from as many meds as I could, and just to kind of have a clear mind moving forward with my life. I would have long discussions with him about death, and he had experienced death traumatically, you know. And he would even say, "Look, I did two tours in Vietnam, and I had people that died all around me." He says, I didn't deal with the way you had to deal with it. He's right, but everybody's experiences are different. They are. You just never. But if it wasn't for him, I would not have been able to kind of pull my way out of it. And that's really the only way you can do it. You can go to all the self-help you want to. You can take as many meds as you want to. But at the end of the day, you have to literally will yourself to good health. And I'm still not perfectly there. There's still things that upset me. We went and saw Joker yesterday, actually, and the trailer for Richard Jewell came on, and it set me back on my heels as I'm sitting there in the previews, because it took me back to that moment in time, very real time, you know. And I remember standing over the body of Alice Hawthorne, you know, at that scene. You know, and she's caught a wood screw in her eye, and it lodged in her cerebellum. I'll never forget that as long as I live, Dan. You know, and that we could have had 400 people die that night. You know, those types of things stay with you. My wife was saying afterwards, she says, "Yeah, I don't know if we're going to be seeing the movie or not, but it might be a test of how healthy I am if I can go and watch that movie." I think, but yeah, it is an ongoing journey for me, an ongoing journey.
Yeah. This book, certainly, you talk about stays with you. This book and the examples that you have from everything from, you say there's a sloshing around in human excrement and maggots that make a body look like it's come to life. When you look at a crack-addicted woman and then realize that she got frustrated with her baby and hit his head on a bedpost. All these things that you have to live to endure, to handle, the nightmares, the dreams, the reoccurring dreams. It's a fascinating account, this journey. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Blood Beneath My Feet, Joseph Scott Morgan. For those people that might want to take a look at other work, what else you're doing, I know that I just looked on YouTube. Can you tell us a little bit where they might be able to look at other work or about this book itself? And also tell us again about Dead Wives Club, please.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I've got my own YouTube channel. They can just plug into Joseph Scott Morgan. It's generally updated weekly, and it's clips from Law and Crime. We cover the biggest trials in the country. I do that as a representative of Jacksonville State University. I'm their forensics guy, pretty much a go-to guy, you know, that we cover all of the cases that are currently going on out there. You can see some of my clips from HLN. I talk about the Epstein case, I think extensively, also the trouble that was had down in the Caribbean this past summer. Isn't that interesting how that kind of dropped off the news where everybody was dying? It just kind of vanished. All of the cases, Jody Arias, Trayvon Martin, everything that I've been involved in now since 2013 relative to that. I think there's even a book trailer on there for Blood Beneath My Feet, believe it or not, from those number of years back when the book dropped. Blood Beneath My Feet can be found on Amazon. It's in print, edition, and also an ebook, Kindle, that sort of thing. So it's out there to be had. You can find it, worldwide, you know, whether you're, you know, listening here, in America, or if you're in, you know, Canada or Great Britain, it's available through Amazon.
It's a powerful account, and I want to thank you very much, Joseph Scott Morgan, for coming on and talking about Blood Beneath My Feet. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Joseph Scott Morgan. You have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. Bye-bye.